What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Knox McCoy. I'm super excited for you to hear from Knox. He's somebody I've known of for a long time. He is the co-founder of the Popcast Media Group, and they put on the shows The Popcast and The Bible Binge, which I am a big fan of. My wife and I actually have been to a Popcast live show here in Chicago. They're just doing amazing stuff. I've had his COO, Aaron Moon, on. You can check the older episodes for that one. It's really good. And so I saw Knox had a book coming out called All Things Reconsidered. And I was like, hey, this is the time to get him on the show to talk about the book. And so I have to tell you, I was not sure what to expect. I had read his previous book, The Wandering Years, but All Things Reconsidered is real good. It's a very enjoyable book. And it's about that. It's about like how we reconsider things, how we reconsider ideas. And it's not like, here's a bunch of theological concepts, let's reconsider them. He goes through all sorts of amazing stuff in his humorous style, through this book. And it's really an enjoyable read. It's also thought provoking. And we talk a lot about that in this episode. We talk about pop culture. We talk about what it means to use pop culture for God's kingdom. And then we talk about reconsidering all things. And so you get a lot out of this episode. It's an enjoyable episode, I have to tell you. You're just going to love hearing from Knox. If you've never listened to him before, he's just really easy to listen to and a great guy. And that shows in this episode. And so I can't wait for you to hear it. Just a quick reminder that you make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford. You can stay up to date with the podcast at all those places. And yeah, I hope you enjoy reconsidering all things with Knox McCoy. Knox, man, it's so good to hang out a little bit and chat. Thanks for coming on the podcast, man.
Man, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I love being here. So I'm very excited to talk today.
That's awesome, man. Well, let's just jump off here and just have you kind of introduce yourself a little bit to everyone.
Yeah. So my name is Knox McCoy, married to my wife, Ashley. She's Blue Swell on Instagram. We got three kids, live in Birmingham, Alabama. Professionally, I am the co-owner of a podcast company. We call it the Popcast Media Group. We have the Popcast with Knox and Jamie. It's my business partner, Jamie Golden. We also do the Bible Binge together. And then we have a new show that's just me, All Things Recapped, where right now I'm recapping Survivor, but, you know, I'll do movies, TV shows, stuff like that. And then, you know, lastly, and I always forget this part, man. Like, I'm always like, oh, yeah, and then books. I wrote books. Like, it was my whole dream of life.
Yeah,
that thing as well.
The little side thing.
Right. So I've written two books, The Wandering Years, which came out in 2018. And then most recently I finished All Things Reconsidered. That's due out, this June. So that's pretty much it.
Dude, that's nice. It's like you rehearsed that or something. That was well done.
I've said it a time or two.
I can only imagine. That's awesome. Okay. Let's dig back through the story then, kind of the trajectory to, cause I mean, owning a podcast media group is, you know, unique, I would say.
Sure.
So how did you get started in even like podcasting?
No. Okay. So, you know, I started, I think my, you know, I arose out of the primordial soup of into the internet in like 2008, you know, and I was kind of a frustrated writer and I was doing the blog thing like everybody else was. And, at a certain point I went to a blog conference and met some friends I'd already kind of been close to and we'd, talked a lot on the phone. And it was there I met Jamie and I met Aaron Moon, who we all share an office now. We have a business together. But before them, it was these three other guys. And they were like, hey, we've been looking into this podcasting thing and we want to try it. And at that point, I'd been listening for a long time because a lot of my work was very monotonous and I had a lot of solitude. So I was like, I can listen. And I just remember thinking, that is so dumb. What a waste of time. You know what I mean? Like how audacious to think you could do something like that. But of course, I was a frustrated writer, so I was like, maybe this could help me write a book eventually one day. So we started doing a show, and that's when I kind of learned the ins and outs, and I learned, I think part of the thing with blogging that I didn't realize in the moment but was like lurking in the subconscious was to get someone to read your blog, you have to get their attention, get them to spend time on this specific web address. And you have to be good enough that you keep them. Right. And I wasn't good at any of those things. Mm. So with podcasting, though, it was like, man, you can do this. You can talk and people can run errands. And there was an interesting aspect to that that I thought this could scale a little bit. So from there, I stopped podcasting with those guys, developed a podcast network with my, my best friend, Jason Waterfalls. And, that never took off, because we had, it's a long story. We had a lot of shows, but none of them were hitting really well. And eventually Jason's wife got pregnant. He was like, I need to bounce, 'cause you know, I've got twins on the way. And, Jamie had been on the network and we had done a couple things. And that's when we were like, hey, maybe we should give this a go and just, you know, kind of see what happens.
Right. So, right. Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, yeah. 'Cause even blogging, I mean, it's so saturated, right? And podcasting is now the same way, but it is, I mean, it's this race to sort of like grab attention, like sort of wherever you can. It's like a serious hustle, right?
It really is. And in a lot of ways, I've heard people talk about, you know, are we in a podcasting bubble? And definitely there's a saturation and definitely there's only a certain amount of time people have to listen.
Right.
But in regards to something like, I think it's different it's different from blogging in the sense that there's so much more time people can spend listening as opposed to sitting and reading.
Right.
Plus attention spans are just not suited for that. And with podcasting, you can go longer on a serious topic or you can go a micro podcast. You can go 10 minutes, you know, and there's a lot of different ways to do things there. At least that's what I tell myself. That's the owner of a podcast. Right.
That's true. That's true. But there is an ease to like throwing something on in the car while you're driving. Right. I mean, it's just much easier than, I guess you could do the same with an audiobook, but it feels like there's a lot more time investment into something.
It really
like that,
does.
Right?
Yeah.
For sure. So what was the learning curve like in like sort of, you know, starting this business with, you know, all that? Yeah.
You know, it was pretty steep and, you know, we were joking before we started recording and we were just talking about like just bad audio podcasts and there's a lot. Yeah. And when we were talking, I thought, oh yeah, like I've been totally guilty of that. Like the first, I don't know, 50% of the podcast was bad audio, you know, because I was a English major, you know, in college and I had no intentions to do anything musically or sonically or any kind of, even like, editing software. But it was that thing of, I got, you know, halfway through college and I was like, well, I can't teach. I don't want to teach. What do I do with an English degree? And so it just turns into this thing. So it's a lot of it was self-taught. And, I think some people can self-teach really well. I don't know that I'm one of those. I'm not a finesse guy, you know, but with audio, you do have to become a finesse person. So, you know, in terms of, I think the biggest difficulty really was me teaching myself how to edit because Jamie, my partner, she came into this as a marketing wizard and nothing really changed. She had to learn how to, you know, suit that for the podcast.
Right.
Sure. But she was already very skilled in that regard. And conversely, I was not skilled at all whatsoever, you know? So, but I think, with podcasting, I think the misnomer is you just sit down and you just like talk and it's all gold and then you publish that thing and then you make a lot of money.
Right.
And it's not what I think 2 years in, I found out, oh, you know, what's better than like an hour episode, a really tight 40-minute episode.
Right. Yeah. You're right.
With all the best stuff, you know, and that's when we really started to skyrocket.
Yeah. Well, and that's hard because you do some pretty complicated cutting too as well. Like, right. Because you kind of open the show with a pithy saying or quote or something funny. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah, that was, you know, the first thing I did, it was called the courtesy laugh and I think it went away, but someone republished it or one of the guys. And so you can listen to part of it. I didn't edit that, but I watched the guy who did and something he did. His name is Joseph Craven. He's a good friend still. He would start with a cold open. Yeah. And I remember thinking like, that's genius. I love that.
Yeah,
and you know, even from SNL, you're suited to like, you like this rolling in. And I always like the idea that you hit play and you don't know what you're going to hear, but it's kind of going to be ridiculous and hopefully funny.
Right.
And it gets you in a good mood. You know, that's the plan at least.
For sure. No, I love it. I think that's great. Okay. So something I've been wanting to ask you these sorts of questions forever. Right. But why pop culture? Like, what is it about pop culture that sort of like keeps you like coming back to it or
that's great. I think a lot of it was, you know, growing up, I loved, you know, I grew up in the evangelical South, right? So like you probably, if you're familiar with that, you have a pretty good idea of what my childhood was. You know, there's not a lot of like wrinkles there.
Right.
I was obsessed with playing sports and watching sports. Conversely, I was also like obsessed with 90210. And like Dawson's Creek and the OC and Saved by the Bell, you know, so there were these like two parts of my brain And it was like, they don't really fit at all. But I think a lot of it too was when you're trying to build an audience, it feels like the easiest thing, like as a writer, you know, on the early days of the blog, the easiest thing to write about is the stuff we're all watching. And pop culture presents itself as kind of a language of the people. Hmm. So if you're trying to find commonality, I think a lot of us try to act like, you know, if we're Christians, we can find it over like the book of Deuteronomy. Like, oh gosh, we all know Deuteronomy. Let's talk about Deuteronomy. No one wants to talk about Deuteronomy, you know? People want to talk about The Bachelor because we all watch The Bachelor and that's crazy. Yeah. So let's talk about that. So I think part of it was just an actual affection, enthusiasm, but also too, it's like, they're in a increasingly more fractured world, you know, it's fun to watch stuff together. It's fun to find community together over a common thing that we're watching or a movie or a TV show or something.
Right. Well, because I it's just interesting. Like you say, you're from the Christian, you know, grew up evangelical South. Like there is maybe nothing more antithetical to that way of growing up than like pop culture, right? Like,
or, 100%.
Like, it's just so not in the realm of like what the evangelical South necessarily does or like, you know,
And, you know, Ashley and I, my wife, we moved 2 years ago. And a big component of it was Aaron and Jamie both live in Birmingham. And I love Birmingham, wanted to move. I went to college there for a year, wanted to come back always. Part of it was we knew it was time for a change for our family, you know. But there's like a decent slice of the pie that was like, not only is my work revolving around pop culture, like you mentioned earlier, I also own a podcast company. So that's a difficult conversation to have.
Right.
And not that everyone was like, that's weird, you're the worst. But it was just, you know, when you're in a small group with doctors, lawyers, firemen, policemen, teachers, and you're like, I own a, can we just move on? I don't want to explain what I do. I don't want to do this, you know?
Yeah.
So there was like a bit of an alienation feeling, you know, not, and not that anyone was making me feel like that, but there's like a, I don't fit here. I don't belong here. You know, like I need to find somewhere else that if, even if I don't fit there either, there's not that, those roots of like, what's Knox doing? How does he, do they have money? Do they pay bills? Like what's happening here? You know?
Yeah. So how do you think about sort of infusing like your faith into something like that, into pop culture?
Sure. So, you know, from the job I left to really go overdrive into the podcast was I was lead writer for skitguys.com. And that is that's very much we're a Christian company and we're going to try to have fun here. So already that's like, what do you mean? Like, how do we do that?
Right.
And they make videos and mini movies and they try to, you know, articulate belief and faith in a funny, clever way. And I really love that about them. And I think that was a really good branching off point because already in my head, I knew, like, I'd never thought, you know, I think a rite of passage in growing up in the South, in the evangelical South, is should I become a youth minister if you're a guy? Like, that's just, you just do that, you know? And that was never me. I knew from a very early age, I'm not suited for ministry. And it's not like I'm better than ministry. It's, I would not be good at ministry. You know what I mean? That's not my personality type. That is not my gift. That is not my talent. So I never felt like, oh man, like I got to find out how to be in the God profession. But I think, you know, being at Skit Guys and also never having the mental urgency or insecurity of like, how am I going to be in this ministry process? I think that's always kind of subtly or subconsciously affected the work I do with podcasts because I was always on the team of, you don't have to be in professional ministry to be ministering to people.
Right.
You don't have to be like talking about Bible verses to be speaking to people's heart. You can do that in a lot of ways. And we saw that in the podcast. A lot of people would talk about, you know, this was a stupid episode. You guys talk about really stupid things, but I've got a parent who's going through cancer and this was really, really great just to kind of lose myself in for a little bit. Hmm. And something we've said a lot on the show is we think that we truly believe, and I got this actually as one of the guys from Skit Guys taught me this, humor breaks down walls so truth can enter. So if you can make someone laugh, you can put them at ease and like you can build an investment with them, an equity with them. So then when you do want to talk about some more serious stuff, it's like, okay, I know where this person's coming from. They're not trying to barrage me with a witness and proselytizing. They're just like, they're a good person, and I kind of want to hear what they say. So, you know, we do that, and the podcast is surely more secular and more pop culture. But then a couple of years ago, we also launched the Bible Binge, where I think that's, I won't speak for Jamie. I know that really, because she has been in traditional ministry, and that really was a good step for her of like, now we're actually literally in ministry in what we're talking about here. But for me, it was more, you know, I think this is a really creative, interesting way to talk about the Bible, because I'm not a smart Bible person, but I want to talk about it and I love reading about it. So can we create a space where we have the safety to do that? And we're able to do that mostly because, you know, we take a story, we recap it like it's a book, movie, or TV show, but also we've installed Erin as the Bible scholar because she is traditionally, like, she actually knows what she's talking about. So if we happen to be sacrilegious, we're not trying to be, but sometimes we are unintentionally, she's there to be like, hey, you were sacrilegious. Don't do that. And we're like, great, thank you. So it's a good safety net. And I think a lot of people, when they're thinking about God, talking about God, or talking about the Bible, the stakes feel too high. And it's like, I'd rather just not talk about this than say something that I might go to hell for. That just, I'd rather just, you know, play it safe here. So the plan there and hopefully the ministry there is, we're going to do this show in this episode and invite you in, and you can kind of think and talk in the same ways. And it's okay, because we're pursuing a better understanding of God or the story of the Bible.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and from what I've read, like in your book, and you talked about the Bible Binge and it coming out, I mean, it's been personally very impactful for you as well, right?
Incredibly impactful. It's, I think, you know, when we were testing the idea, because it was on an episode of the podcast where we talked about, I think, siblings, and we ended up talking about Jacob and Esau, and someone said, you should do an episode about the Bible, or a show about the Bible. I'd listen to that. And we started kicking that idea around, and we asked a lot of people close to us, and we were like, what do you guys think if, like, we talked about the Bible? And they're like, don't do that. We can't think of two people less qualified or with less nuance to do that. So we did it anyway. But the process of being like, I'm going to talk about Noah, or I'm going to talk about Jacob, or I'm going to talk about Balaam the donkey. You have to know what you think about that, because people are going to listen, and people are going to say, hey, you said this and I don't know that I like it, or I disagree with it. Right. And I don't know if everyone's like that, but for me specifically, it's like, I don't care if you don't agree with me, but if I'm incompetent about this, or if I prove to be intellectually untrustworthy, that like freaks me out. So we can disagree, but at least I know what I've said and why I've said it. And I like that. So the process of doing that show has led me to a point of like, I got to really double down on why I believe what I believe, and be able to articulate that to people.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's important. And what I love about the Bible Binge is, like, there is that sort of leveling. I feel like people feel like they can't really talk about the Bible or like God unless they have some sort of degree or like, you know, in vocational ministry or whatever. And like, that's just like so far from the truth. I mean, we should be having conversations about the Bible, like, as, you know, just people. I mean, that's how it should be,
you know,
right?
I remember, because have you felt, you know, whatever your church situation is, have you ever been in a, like, have you ever felt comfortable enough to be like, yeah, but like, could this story be a metaphor? Like, is that okay? I like, that's never been my experience, and I don't want to project on other people. Maybe that is a healthy conversation they're having. I remember sitting in a small group and we were talking about Jonah and the whale, and I remember just thinking, I think that's a metaphor. I think it's like a parable, and it's not real, but it doesn't mean it's not powerful, but I did not feel permission. And these are people I'm close with and I do life with.
Right.
And I thought, I don't want to freak anybody out or be the weird guy, so I'm just not going to talk about that. But has that been your experience? Have you felt that freedom, you know, as a believer to not challenge, but just like call into question your understanding of an established story?
I guess so. I mean, I have the degrees though, right? Like I have, and I'm the pastor. So it's like, if I want to, I can, I guess.
You know, you've got the receipts and you're like, I can do whatever I want. I did the time.
But there's another aspect to that where like, you're also, because of that positional authority, it's like, just making sure you handle all those topics, like, I think very delicately, you know what I mean? That's like the really tricky part of it all. Yeah.
So in that respect, is it like you have to be the adult and like, you feel like I can maybe think these things, but if I say something, that's going to freak people out. If Knox says something, what does he know? He barely graduated with an English degree. That doesn't matter, you know, but you have degrees, so you had to be more careful. Is that like how you felt about it?
I don't know. I don't know that I've ever actually really like sat down and processed it. I'm a bit of an internal processor too. So
yeah.
I don't know. I feel like if I know something for sure, like if I've done the research and like I have a pretty good feel for something, I am unashamedly open about my opinions. I think
sure.
I'm also very hesitant to sort of like verbally process with this intention of like, hey, this is Curry's like citing this as like gospel truth or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, totally makes sense. Makes sense.
Yeah. But I think in general, we're so partisan, and maybe that's a bad word for it because that sounds political, but we're so like on opposite sides of the spectrum. And like, even in a conversation like we're having, you know, you like hint at little, you give little hints about sort of like what you believe about things in order to sort of like make it comfortable for everybody, you know? So we're all on the same page. And if not, we're about to go to war. Right.
And a lot of it is like you breadcrumb things. And like, right. if I just said Jonah, and I feel like it's a parable, and like you threw up, I'd be like, okay, can't do that. I'll reel it back a little bit, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But I think we're so, it's not just like our belief in a story or a character or a book or whatever in the Bible. There's so much worldview and identity and nostalgia attached to it. So it's not just like you're changing how I understand the story. It's like you are threatening all these other things I've attached to it. And I'm not ready to do that. I'm not ready to have that conversation yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes it's worthwhile.
For sure. Well, I mean, we just like totally inadvertently stumbled into All Things Reconsidered, basically, right?
We did.
So we might as well go there, right?
I think we should.
Yeah.
I think we should.
What was the intention behind writing All Things Reconsidered?
So I, you know, I've written a little bit about this on my newsletter, Sectional Healing, but I thought because I signed a 2-book contract with my publisher, and I did the Wondering Years. I thought I was going to have, you know, sometimes I guess with contracts, when the language is nailed down, you have an idea of what that means and they have an idea and they usually win that battle. So it was this thing of like, I think I have like 2 years and they're like, no, you have like 5 months. So figure it out. And I had a couple ideas I was batting around and I just couldn't like figure them out yet. And the thing I kept coming back to was this idea of reconsideration, because the end of The Wondering Years, it ends with this chapter where my dad's gotten cancer, and it's not the cliche like, oh my God, like why God, why, you know, but it's more like, whoa, this is new. This is like a big hurdle now. What do I actually believe about stuff? So in a lot of ways, All Things Reconsidered is a spiritual successor to that book, or a sequel to that book, not in a Christian way, because I think, you know, The Wondering Years is a very, I don't know, it's a deep dive into the formation of my spiritual identity, right? So it's very forward facing Christian book. This is, you know, the first two sections really are not about God at all. It's just about reconsidering yourself, reconsidering your life. But then the last section very much is. So I think in a lot of ways, the end of The Wondering Years set off this like, what... Not only like, what do I think about my faith, but like, what do I think about anything? Because the premise in the introduction of All Things Reconsidered is so much is happening so fast. We're inundated with information. We have social media. We are barely registering anything that we're thinking or consuming.
Yeah.
But what if we took a second and we were like, well, what if we look a little deeper? And I think that applies certainly to your life and yourself. But, you know, the logical, I didn't necessarily go into it wanting to write about heaven or hell or prayer, but it felt like I can't do this book and not talk about those things because I don't know about those things, you know?
Right. Yeah. It was good. I'm not sure I want to approach this. Okay. So one of the things that kind of was a paradigm shift for me, like in the very front of the book, is you talked about even writing the book and how, you had thought that you kind of like come up with an idea and you write about it, but that writing is more of an exploration, like the process of kind of coming to something is. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think, I don't know, I'm going to mess the quote up, but I'm pretty sure it's Flannery O'Connor. And I think she was like, I write because I need to know what I think about stuff. And I'm sure I murdered that, but that's always resonated with me of like, and this book is probably, and maybe I'm just not that kind of writer. I think a lot of people are writing from a place of authority, and there are some very worthy people who are like, I actually you should trust me, you know, and listen right, to me. Yeah. That's not me. I'm not that person. But I think the thing I try to bring to the table is like, I trust my process, trust the thing I'm trying to accomplish, and not necessarily where I landed, because all of this is through, maybe it's like I'm a voyeur author. I'm like, just watch me. And this might not be pretty or fun, but like, I feel like you can take some stuff that you can apply to your own life out of this. And I, in a lot of ways, I would start out with these topics and be like, so let's talk about what it means. Reconsider home. What does it mean to feel home? What is home? And I'd start and I wouldn't really know what I thought about it. But in the process of unpacking, it would be like, oh, okay, yeah, I feel a theme here. I think I understand a little better, you know, and I think I can resolve this in a very honest and accurate way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you say on one hand, you're not an expert and, you know, but I think your gift and the gift in this book that you like sort of like bring out is your ability, your authenticity like comes out over and over again, because like being able to reconsider like these deeply held, you know, beliefs or whatever takes a lot of authenticity, honestly, you know, a lot of humility, you know? And so I think your expertise comes in sort of like, like you said, the process of like, this is how I make sure that I'm being intellectually honest with myself, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think, and I don't even know if I wrote this in the book or somewhere else, but I think it's, I feel like a lot of people are being authentic right now and it's great. But I think sometimes the authenticity doesn't come with vulnerability. Mm. And that is something that's been really difficult for me. I don't want to be publicly vulnerable at all. Right. Like that is the last thing my personality type wants to be. But for me, like with a book like this, vulnerability was a requirement. Mm. You know, it felt like if nothing else, I have to be very transparent and honest. Otherwise this comes across as like, and then I lived happily ever after and everything's so good. You know, it's like, hey, I don't know. I think I have some problems here that I have to deal with. That isn't really the point of this chapter, but just I'm aware of this now in the process of writing this chapter. And I think, I don't know. And I think we're all guilty of it. I'm certainly guilty of it. The curation of identity and of like experience and of life, that is, I don't even know if that's, that feels just like a prerequisite of being on the internet in any capacity. Yeah. So it's not like someone is specifically guilty of it. We're all guilty of it. But I think there needs to also be some uncurated vulnerability there. That isn't like, my biggest weakness is that I care too much. You know, like, no, that doesn't count. It needs to be like, I don't like who I am as a person. I don't like my personality type. And I'm really always trying to re-engineer that and change it. And what does that mean like psychologically, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, those are the hard things to talk about. Right. And I think if anybody truly understands, I know you're Enneagram. If you truly understand your sort of Enneagram type, like, I think there's a natural predisposition to not like, you know, the things that you find out about yourself. Right.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, there was a honeymoon phase for me where I was like, because I'm an Enneagram 5 and I'm like, I love being Enneagram 5. It's the best. It's like, I'm biased, but I love it. It's incredible and it's the best. But, you know, there was certain stuff with the podcast where I would, you know, certain different requirements where I was like, oh yeah, this is a real liability. This is a huge liability. And not only that, like I've, you know, idolized my dad and I always wanted to be like him, and he's a 3, and threes get so much done. They're so good at everything. And I've internalized wanting to be like that, but I don't have the reserves. I just can't do that. Mm. So there's that balance of like, it was finally this dawning on me of like, oh yeah, like your Enneagram sucks, you know, just like everyone else's has sucky parts, but it was really like, actually it's not the best. And you're really bad at a lot of components of this thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's the tricky part of it all. Right. Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. I very much get that and resonate with that. So why do you think that we are so, like, as you wrote this book, I guess, as your discovery process went on, like, what do you think it is about us that is so hesitant to like reconsider things?
You know, I think it was a little bit of what we talked about earlier. It's just there. I think one, it's time. I think we just don't have time. And it's like, I've got 3 kids and there's soccer and lacrosse, and maybe I could rethink what I think about hell, but like that feels like a lot. And I just don't have time for that right now, you know? But I think a lot of it too is what we were saying earlier. It's, there's so much, identity and experience. I think a lot of it, man, I don't know, like I don't want to like prosecute everyone's belief. So I'm going to paint with a broad brush, but I don't really know if this specifically applies to everybody. I think a lot of us, I'll speak to myself. How about that? For myself, I grew up in the church. I was, 33-ish. And I was like, oh yeah, I just don't know what I believe about anything. I know the talking points.
Right.
And I know what I've learned, but I don't know. I've accepted this idea of Satan. I don't know what I believe about Satan. Right. I don't know what I believe about heaven. My idea of and I think I talk about in this book, my idea of heaven was like lazy rivers, chicken nuggets, freaking velociraptors that are friendly. Like, what are you talking about? You know? And like, sure, a lot of that's blown out and like dumb, but there was a component of like, I need that to be heaven and I don't need it to be just an eternal worship service because right. I don't want to do that. That sounds like the worst, you know?
Yeah, right.
Is there anything to land on? So in terms of reconsideration, I think it's a scary thing. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, especially Christians, think you pull one little thread, whole thing comes down.
Right.
So best not to just pull the thread. And maybe you're a little wrong, or maybe you don't know exactly what you think and why you think it, but it's better to become like a nihilistic atheist, right? That's worst case scenario for a lot of people.
Right. And I totally agree with you. I just like kept going back to that. Like if there is a thread that could be pulled that wrecks your whole faith, then what is your faith sort of based on then? You know?
Yeah. What's it built on? You know?
Yeah.
And there's a chapter in the book where I felt really compelled to write it because I thought I'm poking a lot of holes right now in myself. And, you know, to be fair, I talk about a lot of important things I feel like are important spiritual issues to me. Some I change, some I stay the same, and some I'm like, I don't know. And I think that's okay for everybody. It's okay to say, I don't know about what you believe and keep pursuing that thing. But I felt really compelled to write a chapter of like, here's why I stay. Here's why I'm here. And it because I'm always prone to being on that cliff of like, nothingness and nothing matters and nothing's real, you know, and probably this is a simulation, you know? And I think if nothing else, while you're reconsidering, or even if you're not, I think it's important to identify like, what is the thing that keeps you no matter what? And the thing you find all of your faith in, and maybe it's Jesus and that's cool. But like, what aspect of Jesus, what line are you drawing from that? And that's your anchor. That's your constant. If we're going to, do you watch Lost? You Lost fan?
I have not, unfortunately.
You have not. Okay, so there's a Desmond Penny. It's going to go over your head, but people have watched Lost. They're like, yes, 100%.
Yes.
What's your constant in your faith and what keeps you there? Mm. And I think that's, I don't know, maybe that's the first thing you do, and then you start pulling apart some stuff because otherwise it can get a little buck wild in there. But I think it's important to like not just reconsider stuff, but also like consider the thing that keeps you tethered to some kind of faith, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Totally. No, I totally agree. And community is, I think community is an important part of all of that. Like
100%. As an Enneagram 5, I'm like, I don't know about that, but I recognize the truth of what you're saying, you know, even though I'm not good at that.
Right. Yeah, totally. So my worst fear was just realized in that, like, you gave a pop culture reference and I had no idea what was going on because I'm so pop culture illiterate. Like, or I'm like pop culturally sensitive to like weird areas of the world, like underground hip hop or something, like which makes no sense, you know, but like general pop culture, I'm so ignorant about most of it, I guess.
Do you feel shame about that, or do you feel pride in that?
Ooh,
or has that changed?
Man, good question. I don't know that I feel either way. It's just never seemed like a priority to me or like worth investing like copious amounts of time, you know?
Yeah. Well, you have theology degrees instead. I don't. So I know about Lost, you know?
More important than that, though, I also have 3 children like you do. And my cultural expertise now is like children's movies that I've watched over and over again. Right.
You know? Oh yeah. And to be sure, if we didn't have a business based around pop culture, I would not have an expansive knowledge as I do. I still love it fundamentally, but I wouldn't be as, you know, expansive about it. But I think that's a lot of people. It's like, you don't have to know everything about pop culture.
Right.
You like be enthusiastic about the things you're enthusiastic about. And that's cool.
Right.
Cause there's such a rich tapestry out there of pop cultural things to be excited about.
Yeah, for sure. No doubt. Yeah. Sorry. I had a follow up. I had a thought and then I totally got lost. So
don't you hate that? I feel like that's happening to me more and more now.
It's an old guy.
You got to write stuff down, man. Cause I do not remember anything.
I feel like though, it like when I write stuff down in an interview like this, it becomes like inauthentic in my mind, like, because it's such a conversation. Like, I don't want to be like constantly thinking of questions while you're talking, you know? So,
yeah. Well, see, I'll write stuff down and it'll be like, it'll be a thing. I'll be like, shadow, write the word shadow and you'll remember. And then I'll just be like, what is this? What have I done?
Now there's a, now there's a mystery to unravel here. I did. Back to the pop culture thing. Do you ever find yourself sort of getting like, is it ever very difficult to sort of stay up on pop culture for you?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's it is because there's just no time. And I never will be the dad that's like, go away, child. I have to binge the third season of Altered Carbon or whatever, you know?
That's
like, I've got to still play my part of like, I'm a dad. I'm very involved and active and I invest in those relationships. But it's like, that leaves me, you know, 2.5-3 hours a night. And the hard part is you start watching a show and it's like, this sucks, you know? Right. And I've burnt an hour and now I've got to like find something else to watch that I can talk about, you know? So it's tough. It's exhausting. And sometimes it's like, I don't want to watch this super sad show or whatever. Like I started watching Little Fires Everywhere on Hulu. I was like, this it's well made. It's Reese Witherspoon. And it's, I can't remember the other girl's name, but it's like, this is putting me in a bad mood. I don't love, this isn't a good hang, but I know I've got to be able to talk about it, you know? So that's basically, this is how like I'm digging ditches. That's, that's my version.
I get that. No, I get that. I think that's a good analogy for sure.
Kerry Washington. It's Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah. Well, is there the Ashley factor though too? I mean, is sometimes Ashley like, I do not want to watch this, you know?
Yes. Like, 1,000%. And it's a balance because I have to make her watch so much stuff that she does not want to watch.
Right.
That when she's like, hey, guess what? We're watching Outlander and just going to deal with it. And I'm like, you're right. You've earned this. I need to respect this space and this boundary for you.
Yeah. JJ really tried to get me to watch Cheer the other night. And like,
okay,
I just, well, she actually ended up turning it off, but I was like, I'm down if that's really what you want, you know, but just not my thing necessarily, I guess. So.
Sure. But you guys, you got to jump on some of those grenades, you know, because I know she does for me. And I'm like, hey, I'll just do that. I'll do the millennial second screen thing. And I'm watching, but I'm also working and that's okay. You know, and we're still like very happily married. So it works.
That's all that matters right there. Yeah, that's good. Okay. So you talk about a lot of controversial things in the book. I did not expect you in the book to tackle maybe the most controversial thing in the whole book, which is LeBron versus MJ. I was shocked. I could not believe I couldn't believe you delved into those waters. I mean, of all the controversies to like get in big trouble over, that's like a major one. I feel like,
Curry, listen, when I was writing the book, I was like, you can't respect yourself as a human, as a writer, as a sports fan, and not take on this issue because this is an issue I felt very passionate about. And I had to remove the passion. I'd be like, you're not a passionate person. You are a doctor. You're a clinical observer of sports, and you have to approach it like that. And I thought at the end of my research, I was like, yeah, you arrived at the right place here, I think. Where'd you land on LeBron?
No, I'm very on board with you, with the LeBron stuff. I've thought that for a long time. There's so much, and I live in Chicago. People are so emotional about MJ. Like, like they don't even realize like what gets like built up in them to like, they freak out. They lose their minds.
You know, but I think I wish I could say that I did this intentionally. I didn't. But now that we're talking about it, I think that is a really great corollary of like unpacking a spiritual belief, because Michael Jordan, it's not about the stats or the titles. I mean, it is, but a lot of it is just like, I remember being 12 years old and watching him hit that shot against the Jazz.
Right.
And like, you cannot take that from me. Do not take that from me, you know? So there's so much attached to saying, actually, I think LeBron James is the greatest basketball player of all time. It's such a, I don't know, it's a fool's errand to try something like that. But I gotta, you know, the head sees what the head sees. Yeah. And like, that's what it is. LeBron's the greatest of all time.
I'm going to agree with you. We're probably going to get hate mail, but nobody emails me. So you're going to
bring
get
it.
All, so
bring
that's
it.
Fine.
Yeah. Bring it on. Yeah.
I do. And this is like a little probably belaboring the point, but I do wonder even why Kobe was never in the conversation like at all. You know, I mean, he's never sort of in that realm when, I mean, he has stats, you know,
He's got the stats. He's certainly got the titles, you know, and I think if he's ever, okay. So like if he's ever going to be in that conversation, it's now, you know, post his super tragic death. But I think that's another reconsideration of, like, in the moment watching Kobe, a lot of it was like, this sucks. He's a ball hog and he seems like the worst to play with. And I'm not like trying to denigrate him. That was just like the objective analysis of what he is. But I think in his later part of his career, he really turned around once he got Gasol.
Yeah.
And there's something, I think he's as close to Jordan as we're ever going to get. Yeah. And that's the highest compliment you can give someone, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. It's crazy times with all that stuff. So, but you did bring it back to the character piece. And I think that's the piece missing from both of those, Kobe and MJ, that LeBron has really like never stepped into something like major, you know, as far as failing goes, you know.
And the stuff with MJ really got, it just wasn't the media landscape then. Because obviously, you know, so he's a serial philanderer. He had tons of gambling debts.
Right.
He was a butthead to his teammates. That's established. We know that. But it's just that wasn't the media landscape then to hype on that. It, conversely, if LeBron goes on TV and makes a decision to go to Miami and we act like he's crucified a puppy dog, you know, which it was a bad move, but it's like, it's a little different, guys. Yeah, it's a different world. And we need to, just like the rules and the physicality was different back in the day. We have to evaluate these things differently, you know, for a different moment.
For sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, kudos to you for jumping in on that.
Thank you. I feel very brave right now. So you're making me feel better.
I appreciate that. That's good. That's good. Yeah, I mean, the book is just so, you have an ability to write comically, and I feel like it's an ability that like if I try to be funny writing, which I don't often, I just come off like a big jerk, you know what I mean? Like there's a gift to being able to write like comedically, I think.
I appreciate that. I think I've worked a long time to try to develop a voice. I think that's just my natural voice, is to be whatever, but also, like, especially in a book, that doesn't translate always. And I think in certain parts of the Wonder Years, it doesn't translate well, but I think when it does, it is the product of some really good editors. I have one in particular, Megan Porter is her name. You can find her on Twitter. She's an incredible editor, and she'll take you and it'll be like, I know you're trying to be funny here, and you can still kind of get there, but this is not the place for this, you know, don't do that now. Or, you know, there's a sanding or a finessing. So it's the combined efforts of a lot of really talented people to help
you
make
need that
sound good.
You need that sanity somewhere there, right?
You really do.
The footnotes though, my favorite always. So
man, that I think, I don't know if I've stolen that from a billion different people. So I think it started with, as I understand it, and I know they've existed forever, but the comedic, whatever absurd footnote started with David Foster Wallace. And then I think was borrowed by Chuck Klosterman, borrowed by Bill Simmons, and then shamelessly ripped off by Chris Julie. So there's a rich lineage of really great footnote usage.
That is a great lineage right there. Mm. That's awesome. What, as you wrote the book, like, was one of the hardest parts of this, like reconsidering all things for you just on a personal level?
You know, I think the home chapter was difficult because I was in the middle of the move, and our move was tough because we were leaving family, and we were leaving. We had lived in outside Chattanooga, Tennessee for, Ashley had literally never left, and I'd only left for a year. So that was very much home, and all of our families were there, and we were taking kids away. So I mean, taking grandkids away. And that was tough, like emotionally, spiritually, also just like with family. That was hard for everybody to deal with. So a lot of it was like writing that, but also trying to write it in a way that wasn't like, I'm going to silently justify this decision I've made.
Right.
Because what if I wrote that chapter and I was like, actually, that was a mistake. You know, like that was a real fear of mine. Yeah. But I think along with that prayer, the chapter about prayer was really difficult because I didn't realize that I didn't know anything about prayer. And I didn't realize the degree to which I misunderstood prayer. And I don't know that like I super understand it now, but it was like, you know, like when you have like, or your kid has like a necklace and they want to wear it and you're like, yeah, I'll untangle it. And you get it. And it's like, oh my gosh, what happened here?
Right.
You know?
This is a whole different level.
There's not everywhere. What did you do? Right. You know? That's what it felt like writing that chapter.
Well, I'll say that the prayer chapter, was probably the most impactful for me too, because you put words to a lot of the feelings that I've had, personally about prayer, because it's one of those things that we make seem very straightforward, like just as a people. And then you like dig into it and you're like, wait a minute. Like, none of this sort of makes sense, right? Like,
yeah. I appreciate you saying that, because that I was very self-conscious and still a little self-conscious about that chapter of everyone reading it and just being like, how are you making it this hard? It's so easy and you've made it difficult. But I think, before I started writing the book, and especially when I was trying to build the spiritual section out, or the faith section, I did an Instagram story and I was like, what are the things? And this was a point I never really did that. So this is a strange thing for me to do. Like, what are the things you struggle with? What's tough for you? What have you rethought? And a lot of people came back with prayer, and it never dawned on me, you know? And that's when I really started to dig in. So I think that's something that resonates with a lot of people.
For sure. Well, it's one of those stupid platitudes that people bring up. Like, if you're struggling or something, it's like, well, you should just like pray about it or whatever. And like, there's a lot of Christians.
What does that mean? That's nothing. Yes, you just said nothing.
Right.
You know? I mean, you did. And like, I'm not trying to denigrate prayer. Prayer's great.
Right.
I don't understand it, but I'm assuming it's this thing I don't understand, but I want to respect. Hmm. But also, you want to like take it apart a little bit and just be like, when I say, hey, praying for you, that literally is a nothing burger of a thing I just told you.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But I'm trying to articulate that I care about you and I'm feeling for you. Because there was someone who reached out and was like, to our show, and was like, you know, I'm at the Ronald McDonald House. My kids undergoing treatment, and like, I wanted to respond and just be like, "I'm so sorry. That's terrible." And I wanted to add something, but it felt like if I literally said, "Hey, we're praying for you," that would feel so nothing, you know. Right. Even though we literally would be, but there's just a nothingness attached to that statement. Like, what do you do? What do you say in that, you know, situation? So. I don't know. That's just emotional baggage I'm carrying with me.
No, I totally agree. I had to, a long time ago, I had to stop saying that because I would say it and then never act on it, you know? So if I do say that, I want to intentionally be like, no, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to intentionally like, just like lift you up even, you know, just,
no, I'm actually praying. Like I'm for real. I'm praying for you.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the most disingenuous, is to cast it off as like, oh, I'm praying for you, and then not do anything about it. Like, you're into some pretty dark territory there, I feel like.
You're like three layers deep into real sad stuff. Like, so don't do that.
There's a lot of insincerity there. Yeah. No doubt, man. Yeah. But I would do it all the time. Like, because it's the easiest thing to do. And it feels like you did something without actually doing anything.
Yeah. You know? It's the most empty, meaningful thing you can do, you know?
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Good. Well, I enjoyed reconsidering all things. It was very well done.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate that. That was, I really loved The Wondering Years in the process of writing it. I really like this one a lot more. Not, you know, out of disrespecting the first book, but this really helped me figure some things out. So hopefully it can help other people too.
Well, they're very different books, right? I mean,
yeah.
The Wondering Years was so good. I mean, the stories in The Wondering Years are just incredible. I mean, just
thank you.
Right. Like,
well, we did a speaking gig recently in Houston, and, you know, first we started and I made fun of the Astros and people didn't like that. But after that, I was like, you know, I'm a writer, blah, blah, blah. I wrote The Wondering Years, where I figured out how to find God in pop culture. And then I wrote All Things Reconsidered, where I talked about just doubting God. You know, I was like, there's a lot happened personally in the middle of that, but we'll talk about that later. But I think it very much is like, I found God. Now, All Things Reconsidered is like, I want to understand God. You know, right. I think those are two different actions that we often just congeal into one. But I think it's very important to find God or let God find you, you know, but also now you got to understand God. Now you got to take the time to like really take that apart and understand what you think about God and why you think it.
Yeah. Cause there's a value to deconstructing sort of what you believe, right? To sort of like really delving into, you know, but there's also a real need to reconstruct something, you know, in its place. And,
And I think specifically for someone like me, you can deconstruct and then you reconstruct. And I'm glad you said that, because I think a lot of people just talk about deconstruction. I think that's I don't want to say trendy, because that feels like patronizing. It's not, it's a thing our generation, I think, is doing right now.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I don't often hear people talking about reconstruction.
Right.
You know? And I think that's an important aspect, but I also think sometimes you're just not going to know. You're just not going to know. And that's okay. Right. Like, you're not, if this was a God, you know, if you believed in a God that you could figure out and you could like find the manual on, I don't know that that's what you want.
Right.
You know, I don't think that's the deal.
Yes. Yeah. But we're so hesitant to like accept any sort of mystery whatsoever, right? Like our faith is crumbling if like we don't have every single like an answer to every single thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. But it's like that's just there's not a YouTube tutorial. I'm sorry. You know, there's literally a YouTube tutorial for everything, but not this, but that's okay.
Yeah. Right. Totally. No, you're totally right. I think that's a huge struggle for a lot of people. It's just that it's okay not to know or to have all your ducks in a row right now, right?
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I think it's more dangerous to believe something and fight over it just because you feel like if you even thought about it for a minute that everything would fall apart, you know?
Yeah, yeah, defending something and not really know why you're defending it.
Right.
That's the most dangerous alternative, I think. Yeah.
When it's like sort of an evangelical specialty, I think.
Oh, that's right in the playbook. That's page number one.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'm so totally guilty of that as well, you know?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to do. So, yeah. It's good stuff, man. So do you want to like tell us how we can sort of contact you and all that stuff?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So obviously on the socials, I'm just at Knox McCoy. You can find me there. I do a newsletter, Sectional Healing, every week. If you're interested in the book, you can go to knoxmccoy.com/book. What we're doing right now is instead of like doing a launch team, what I've, my publisher and I and Jamie and Aaron, we all put our heads together and we're like, what if we do an unlaunch team or like a best friends of the B word? And what it is like, if you pre-order the physical book, the physical copy of the book before release date, you get access to this private group. And I'm doing like special interview episodes, special content episodes, chapters that didn't make it, new chapters I'm writing, all this audio content that you can listen to all if you just pre-order the book. So go to knoxmccoy.com/book and you can, that'll direct you to the correct place to go to get all that.
That's awesome. That's cool. I love that. Can I just say Sectional Healing is like the best name for a newsletter ever.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. I got to that name. It's a super long story, but I was writing a really bad piece of apocalyptic fiction. Okay. And I pitched it to try to turn into the book.
Wait, could you just stop for 1 second? Did you just say you were writing a piece of apocalyptic fiction?
That's correct.
Okay.
That was my game plan was like, okay, hey, this is going to get you a book deal. Then they're going to turn it into a miniseries slash maybe movie and everything's going to be really great. It wasn't even my agent at the time. I was trying to impress an agent and she read it and like, it was like, I don't know, 15 chapters and I sent it to her and like 12 minutes later, she got it back and I know she did not read it, but she was like, yeah, this isn't going to work for me. But all that to say, within it, the main character owns a furniture store called Sectional Healing. And I was like, man, I love that name so much. And I think I even included in a footnote of the Wonder Years of like, I love this name so much.
Yeah.
And it was like, I don't know how this is a newsletter name, but we're just gonna make it work. So, so thank you for those kind words about
for
it.
Sure. For sure. For sure. Are you ever like in a public space where they're playing like music and all of a sudden the song Sectional Healing comes on, like, and you're with your kids and you're like, how is this part of the playlist?
Listen, I was somewhere and it was like a Gap or something or a food court and they were doing Boys to Men, I'll Make Love to You. And I was like, look, I love the song. This takes me back.
Right.
I don't know that this is a place for it. You know what I mean? I don't want to be trying on like a sweater vest and being like, I'll Make Love to You is playing. I don't know. That's me. That's, you know, maybe we're different than other people. I don't know.
I think we probably pay attention to music and no one else does maybe, or
probably.
I don't know. It just seems so funny to me. Yeah. So anyway, just real quick. So we meet in a community center for our church, you know, and, they play music on the outside. So like you'll be walking into church and like Sectional Healing is playing like as you're entering church. It's like,
unbelievable.
It's actually kind of cool. You know I mean? It's like we don't take ourselves too seriously here, you know.
It's the real line of demarcation of like, now you're in church, now you're not in church. Well, it's right there.
You know, if you're offended by that, you're probably going to be offended by what's in here. So, you know. Good. Okay, so are you ready to jump into our final two questions?
100%. Let's do it.
Sweet. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Okay, so I was an assistant baseball coach in college. That's not that strange. But I just did it for a year. I wasn't paid. So that was a little strange.
Sure.
And then I was a celebrity gossip beat writer. So my dad and I, we had a sporting goods store and a screen printing shop. After we sold those, I was like, I'm going to become a writer. And I had all these freelance gigs lined up. And this celebrity gossip bee writer was like the big piece of the financial puzzle. It was like the one we were really leaning on. And I'd have to get up like 4:30, and I would take like the 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. shift. And I'd have to write like 10 stories about what's going on, like with pregnant Kim Kardashian, a lot of that. And that was a tough one. That's the wildest job I've ever had.
That's
without question.
That's impressive. That is, yeah.
It's like 5:27 a.m. and you're trying to make like a pregnant Kim Kardashian story relatable to the internet. That's like, it's not rock bottom,
right?
But it is, because you haven't, like, if you're there, like, things aren't great. You know what
right.
I mean? Like,
yeah,
this
there's
isn't
a lot
ideal
of,
for anybody.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of factors coming together there.
Yeah.
I get that. Okay, sweet. So my final question is then, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
You know, I would say, and I think we talked around it earlier, I would say, like, a lot of people feel like if you're not in ministry, you're doing like less than God's work, right. Or you're, you know, in the suburbs of God's kingdom, not in like the city limits of right. God's kingdom. Mm-hmm. But to me, I feel like everything's ministry. Your work, sure. How you go to the grocery store, everything, every interaction, how you conduct yourselves, how you love on people, how you take interest in people, that's ministry.
Right.
So be someone, you might not be able to start like a Bible study in your work. That's okay. Just like be really great to people, be invested, care about people. And that, I know that doesn't have the, you know, neon flashing lights of like, I'm a Christian, like you should respect what I'm doing here. But I think that stuff, I think the little things go such a long way in contributing to the bigger portion of like God's kingdom and the bigger representation of like what God wants for people and his heart for people and seeing that through you. So I think treat that like, just treat it like everything you do is ministry. And I think that's a pretty good way to go about life.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's great, man. I appreciate it. Dude, thanks for coming on. It was so fun to chat and love the books and the podcast, you know,
man, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a really fun conversation. So thank you for taking the time.
Thanks, man. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Knox. I just want to remind you that everything that he talked about is in the show notes. You can find the book there. You can find all the links easily clickable there in the show notes to make it easy for you. I'm a nice guy. That's what I do. And I hope you enjoyed reconsidering things. I hope you check out the book. It really is a great read. It's really helpful, I think. And so, yeah, I just encourage you to do that. Make sure you're listening to the podcast and Bible Binge too. Those are great things to do, especially in a pandemic. You've got a little more time on your hands, maybe. Just great places to check out the podcast, especially as just a lot of levity in this situation. And so I highly encourage all those things. You can swipe to the bottom of your iTunes app right now and leave me a rating and review. That's super helpful just to get the word out about the podcast, let people know what we're doing at Theology of Hustle. And I hope that you are staying safe out there. So until next time, get out there or stay in and hustle.